You are entering the Royals Podcast Network.
A show that looks at Kansas City baseball's past, present, and future.
Belted to left field. Billy comes through tonight. Splash!
This is the Kansas City Baseball Vault.
And welcome into the Kansas City Baseball Vault, brought to you by Kelly's Westport Inn. Ladies and gentlemen, we have a lot to talk about tonight. Not particularly this exact evening for the day we are recording is June 9th, and it is raining, and the Royals game has been postponed, possibly the last Yankees game for Derek Jeter ever in Kauffman Stadium. That will never be. But anyway, we still have a lot to talk about. As always, I am your host, Jeff Herr, and with me, of course, is the fastidious Michael Engel. Mike, how you doing tonight?
I was going to try to write down a list of things that you might use as the adjective this week, and I just didn't get around to it. But next week, I'm gonna put down three, and we'll see which one you end up. How close
right.
I am.
All right.
We'll just see.
I like this game. At some point, maybe like a year from now, I think it'd be interesting to go back and pick out all of them that were used, and then we'll
put them into one super mix.
Yes, there you go. That's actually a fantastic idea. I'm totally like, that.
You have that, and Kamler always had where he would add a title every week to whatever I was doing. It's like, I don't know what the deal is with you guys, but whatever.
Hey, you know,
I'll roll with it.
Just trying to inject a little bit of life into this whole podcast. Not that we need it.
Anyone who's hung out with either of us knows that
we are full of life, ladies and gentlemen.
Two wild and crazy guys.
So, on that note, we should get back to baseball.
Yeah, that didn't take long.
No, it did not. It did not take. That's what happens during rain delays, though. It's that was a Rex Hudler moment for the evening.
Ball players get stir crazy. Podcasters reference 1970s
Saturday Night Live
SNL skits.
Yes, you know, that's so, the way it goes.
Sure.
So first, we'll just kind of talk. We'll recap things. We've got the Royals actually playing some decent baseball, and the draft that they had last Thursday. But before we get into the draft, we'll talk about just the Royals recently. Last time we talked, they had just won the first game of a four-game set against the Cardinals. I guess a four-game set is kind of a loose term in that scenario, because it was two in St. Louis and two in Kansas City. but four games in a row against the Cardinals, and the Royals end up winning three out of four. And the one that they lost was in 11 innings and very well could have won. And the question, or the weirdest thing, and I was telling Mike this before we got on air, but and I sent an email to my dad this week, and after they had won two straight against the Cardinals, or last week, I'm sorry, after they had won two straight against the Cardinals, and I said, you know, this is the first time in my life that the Royals and the Cardinals have been an evenly matched game, legitimately, and I don't know what to do with myself. I mean, what were your thoughts on that series, Mike?
I thought it was pretty cool because, you know, so often, you know, the Cardinals would just come in and just crush the Royals, and it's really depressing. And to even go to a game at the K, it's usually most of the fans there are Cardinals fans, and so it's pretty depressing to be there and have to endure that kind of thing. But they came out, and you know, the Cardinals, they're not maybe as good as they have been. Their offense is really pretty rough. Their starting pitching still as good as it's been. Their bullpen is, you know, off and on here and there. So, but to take three out of four, it's really encouraging. I mean, they won two games in St. Louis. They looked pretty good. Duffy had a really solid game. And then they come back to Kauffman, and they get Yordano Ventura back, and he has a nice game too. You know, if you told me at the beginning of the year that the Royals would play the Cardinals four games and James Shields would have the worst start of those four games, I'd be kind of surprised.
You'd think the other ones were really bad.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's pretty encouraging to go in take two in St. Louis, and then end up, you know, still, even though they looked miserable against Wainwright, they still had a shot even down to the end. So, and really, the right set of events, they could have, and I think almost should have won the game, but, you know, they just didn't get it executed, and, you know, that happens, I suppose. So, yeah, I mean, that's pretty encouraging, and I was in Des Moines this weekend with a group of friends, and probably a third of those people are people from St. Louis who don't really follow baseball, but they'll follow the Cardinals lightly just to kind of know what they're doing. And every year when I see them, they're like, hey, see about how the Cardinals are doing? I'm like, this weekend I was able to toss that back and throw it back at them. So that, you know.
We'll have a little story time for a second here. I went to school in Missouri, and it was the majority of the people that I went to school with were from St. Louis. And so I had a lot of friends who were Cardinals fans. And when I was in grad school at doing my master's in accounting, one of the girls that was in our class was this huge Cardinals fan, and it was Cardinals Royals. So this would have been 2008, and it was Cardinals Royals, and the Cardinals won – or I'm sorry, the Royals won the first two games of a three-game series. And I said, all right, if if the Royals sweep, then you have to wear my Royals jersey and my Royals hat to class all day long. And if the Cardinals win just the one game, then I will wear Cardinals gear all day long. And they freaking won. And so she had to wear Royals gear to class all day long. That was probably my best Royals Cardinals story that I've ever had, because there's not many good ones besides the 85 World Series, which I take very little ownership of because I was 6 months old at the time.
I probably told this story last year after the Cardinals series, but when I was a freshman at KU, it was finals week, and I had a 7 a.m. final or something, so I'm trying to go to bed. And because it's finals week, everybody else decides that, you know, that's when you're going to go out. So like 3-4 in the morning, these guys get home and they're arguing in the hallway about the 85 World Series and Denkinger's call. And so I have to sit there and listen. They're right outside my door, and I'm wide awake now. I'm just like, God dang it. You know, 1985 just always seems to come up. But no, I'll tell another one that I'll tell real quick. We didn't really plan to do this, but that's fine. I think it was 2007. I went to a game in Kansas City against the Cardinals. And I think it was like in 2007, every time I went, it was either Odalis Perez or Jorge De La Rosa starting without fail.
Of course. Like,
just never anybody else.
Mainly because the Royals cloned them and they did actually start every game.
Sure. Bold move. Let's see how that works.
Yes.
Nope. And, you know, first inning, I think Chris Duncan hit a 3-run homer or something. This obnoxious Cardinals guy behind me is yapping about, man, I paid $100 for these seats. And I turn to the guy next to me. I'm like, I paid $8. Like, all right. Nice. And later on, the Royals in the next inning batted around. And then in the second inning, they batted around again. And the guy is just yapping. He's drunk at this point on his butt or whatever the heck. And, you know, he's still yapping. I show him my scorecard and I'm like, I ran out of space. We just keep scoring runs, man. And later, about the sixth or seventh inning, his girlfriend was hammered as well and ended up throwing a beer on another girl and they got kicked out. It was pretty great.
There you go. That's like a Deadspin article right there.
Yeah. 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 So that's, probably my most fun Cardinals game that I've been at. And the Royals won like 10-3 or something like that. So
nice.
All the better.
Indeed. So that was a fun little story time there from Mike and myself. But to get back to the Royals and how they're playing, they take 3 out of 4 from the Cardinals. And then they come in. And as I said, the day we're recording this, or June 9th, they're actually the fourth game of the Yankees series has been postponed. Who knows when they'll make it up. But I guess postponed isn't the correct word. It's been rained out, because postponed would mean they could still start it today, I suppose. But
I think August 25th is the date that I saw. I just kind of glanced at Twitter and
I heard that there were 3 days that they had with common days off, so I'm sure they'll be able to work something out. Although, depending on how the season unfolds, it may be one of those things where they end up having to wait until the end of the year when it's going to matter. But I mean, the way this thing is shaping up right now, there's a real good chance that that game matters, not only for the Royals or the Yankees, but for both of them. Because right now the Yankees are sitting at what are they, 32 and 31, and the Royals are 31 and 32.
Yeah.
So I mean, they're kind of neck and neck here. So if it comes down to the wild card, that game could be important. But of the three games that they played of this 4-game series, the Royals have won 2 of 3. So I mean, they took 2 out of 4 from the Blue Jays, 3 out of 4 from the Cardinals, and now 2 out of 3 from the Yankees with one game still pending. So I mean, they're kind of stringing together a little bit of luck here, and there are some wins here, and they're kind of, the offense is picking up a little bit. I mean, they've scored, they scored 8 runs 2 nights ago. They scored 8 runs against the Cardinals. They scored 6 runs against the Cardinals. I mean, they still have a couple two or three run games, and they were shut out by the Blue Jays. But I mean, they've had a little bit more of a breakout. I mean, do you see encouraging signs from the offense, or is it just another possible blip on another season to below mediocrity?
Well, they're getting a lot out of Alex Gordon's doing a lot. Sal Perez is kind of, you know, for a while there, he was starting to slump, and he has come back and, you know, homered the other day. I think they're looking better. And I think from where they were when they replaced Pedro Grifol with Dale Swaim, they really had nowhere to go but up. I mean, they're dead last in things like isolated power, and I didn't check if they were last in on base, but I would not be surprised. At the very least, you know, they're probably one of the lowest walk rates. They still don't have a lot of power and home runs. I mean, they're starting to hit a little bit more. Osmer hit another one. Finally, Gordon went on a little streak there. But still, it's pretty slim pickings as far as, you know, guys showing a lot of that power. So until you see something where they're getting on base more, or they're hitting for more power, it's still got to be a little tentative before I start thinking that the offense is going to look better. Just because, you know, that's kind of what these guys have been through a lot of their career. And especially right now where you've got guys like Hosmer and Infante and Aoki all really struggling. You know, you can't just be Alex Gordon and Lorenzo Cain carrying the offense. But it's definitely encouraging, and the pitching is still good. They're fortunate to get Yordan Ventura back, and he pitched well against the Cardinals as well. And that, you know, that's just after missing one start from his elbow thing. So that's best case kind of scenario. And, you know, that's encouraging. And we were talking, I think it was 2 weeks ago, shortly after the Houston series, where, you know, the stretch with the Blue Jays and the Cardinals and the Yankees coming up was, you know, could easily just tank the Royals. And they come out of it looking pretty good. They won, what, 7 out of 11 against those three teams. And, you know, they're all pretty quality teams. So that's definitely an encouraging sign. And, you know, a little bit more power was a big part of that from, you know, some key guys. So, you know, it's at least something to kind of look at. I'm still not, you know, like Mellinger says, there's always that monster around the corner. I'm still not sure that thing's dead. So just got to keep watching out. But, you know, you can't really complain too much about the last couple weeks of results, or at least past the Houston series. So I'm happy with that.
Yeah. So then the question becomes, can they pull this kind of mini good stretch here and start winning some games against the division?
Yeah.
And they've got 9 games coming up against division opponents. And as of now, they're 5-16 against other Central Division teams. So as of last year, you know, they were 15-4 against a team like the Twins. Well, I mean, they're just getting killed by everybody in the division this year. And if you want to win the division, the first thing you got to do is win your division. You know, I mean, that sounds stupid, but what that means, you've got to beat the teams that are in your division, because that's the best way to help yourself. Because not you immediately, you know, we had this problem last year when the Royals start doing really well and they win 15, 16 out of 20 games. Well, it didn't really matter because Cleveland and Detroit were doing the same thing, really, and we just didn't talk about it as much because they weren't the Royals. So when you start winning on the heads-up matchups, it's like, okay, well, now you absolutely do 100% pick up ground on the team that you just beat because they couldn't beat anybody else to keep pace. So, I mean, they need to beat these teams in the division. They got 9 games coming up, 2 against Cleveland at home, and they hit the road for 3 against Chicago and 4 against Detroit. And Chicago is Chicago, and they've done better than I think people would think this year. But, I mean, they're still not inspiring anyone to believe in anything. And then also, I mean, Detroit looked like they were going to run away with this thing and it wasn't going to be close, and they are scuffling big time. I mean, do you think, when you look at these next few games, I mean, I got to think this lines up pretty well for the Royals. If you're looking at Cleveland right now is probably playing the best of the 3 teams between Cleveland, White Sox, and Detroit, and you got them at home. And then if Detroit keeps scuffling, I mean, I'm thinking this, if they're going to make some noise against the division, this is probably the best stretch they've had so far to have that opportunity.
Yeah, they've got some guy, you know, like I said, Gordon's been hitting great and Kane has been good pretty much all year. Escobar's, you know, he had the first couple weeks of the year, he didn't have a hit. And then since, he's been fine. I mean, he's been a fine contributor. The pitching's been good and the bullpen's been mostly good. Some issues here and there. But yeah, I mean, playing against these teams, that's what you've got to do. Like last year when they went on that 16-20 stretch, I think they made up one game in the standings because the other teams were doing great. Right now, they've got a shot. I mean, with Detroit, they've been really rough. Miguel Cabrera might have a hamstring thing that he's going to be dealing with. He's in the lineup today, but people were scared yesterday after hearing about it. And their bullpen has been miserable. They have a 7.71 ERA in the 9th inning this year, which is, you know, with Joe Nathan, who they signed, you wouldn't expect that, but nobody's been all that good. And, you know, Jabba Chamberlain gave up a big hit and against Boston, and they haven't been very good as a bullpen. And that's always been kind of a problem for Detroit, but it's really been a problem now. So they haven't, you know, it's they're not as scary right now. So that's something that, you know, that 4-game series is going to be a pretty big deal. And the White Sox, I mean, they've hit pretty well, but, you know, it's they did have a little bit of time without Chris Sale. Chris Sale is back. I haven't looked ahead to see if he's lined up to pitch in that series, but I would probably bet he is, because it seems anytime the Royals run into Chris Sale, they're going to run into Chris Sale. And he's been dominant since he came back from the disabled list. So that's fun. But you're absolutely right that they've got to win games against their division, because, you know, that's what, you know, it's going to be tough for them to sneak into the wild card with teams that are just more talented than them. So if they can beat teams in their division, give themselves an opportunity to get in that way, that's what they got to do. Moreover, I mean, they just got to win. And I don't know what their problem against the division has been, but, you know, they haven't looked good against anybody. And so this is a pretty important stretch right now. And, you know, they're playing well enough right now that at least you're not afraid, I suppose. A week and a half ago, I would have probably felt a lot different just because I didn't think they'd do so well over this stretch that they're just coming out of. So, you know, it's an opportunity for sure.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at it like this, they've got 2 games against Cleveland coming up. They're 1 game behind Cleveland. So they win these 2 games and they leapfrog them into second place, and they're a game ahead of Cleveland. And they got 3 coming up against the White Sox. Well, right now they're a half game ahead of the White Sox. So if they can rip off 2 out of 3, then they can put a game and a half a distance between them, or better yet, sweep the whole thing. And then you're looking at 2 games better. And then the Tigers in a 4-game series, they've won 6, only 6 out of their last 20 games. I mean, if you go back and look at their schedule, it looks pretty ugly. There's a lot of L's they've been hanging up here. I mean, they're still, to put into perspective how good of a start they had, they've been 6-14 in the last 20, and they're still 33-26. So, I mean, and they've still got a very comfortable lead on the division of, well, I guess it's not, it's like four games. So I wouldn't say very, but it's comfortable, more comfortable than you would normally expect after a 6-14 stretch. So, I mean, if it seems like, you know, throughout my life and most of our lives as Royals fans, whenever they get to that wall, right, and you have to take they have to take that step and jump over that wall, they always fall flat on their face. I mean, it was 2012 and they were coming up near 500 and people were like, hey, maybe the Royals are going to compete a year or so earlier than people thought. They were going great. And I remember this distinctly. They had a four-game series against the Twins. The Twins were bad and everyone was like, oh man, they can win 3 out of 4 or maybe sweep all of them. They'll be undefeated. And they just get swept in a four-game series at Kauffman. Boom, season was over. You know, and then you had last year, you know, they started off 17-10 and they really needed to take a hold of the division. They were in first place. The furthest into the season they'd been in first place since 2003. And then boom, 4-19, just flat on the face. Those are just two recent examples from the last 2 years. You know, so it just seems like every time they get to that precipice, instead of actually jumping over it, they just fall right in. And this is another one of those times. The Royals are one game below 500. If they win 7 out of their next 9, then, you know, all of a sudden they're 4 games over 500. And if they win enough of those against the Tigers, then maybe they're only a game, 2 games behind in mid-June, you know? So then you're definitely in contention. And when the trade deadline comes around, you can make a move to hopefully get that player that puts you over the top. Maybe they get a bat or something. You know, I'd probably trade Greg Holland, you know, because closers always seem to have high value around the trade deadline. So, I mean, that's a different topic. We don't need to flesh that out at this point, but I feel like we're probably going to, the way the Royals have been middling and just kind of winning a few here and then losing a few there. And we're going to say this multiple times again throughout the season, but in this 9-game stretch here could really define the season. But this time we're talking about it in a good way. You know, they could, they could catch these teams at the right time and put some distance and close some gaps between them and other teams. And then now we're looking at these Royals in a much more positive light. You know, if they come out of this and they win 7 out of 9, and they're 38-34, that looks a lot better than, you know, what they could have been had they, you know, fallen flat on this 9-game stretch.
Yeah, I hope. I mean, I want to believe so much. They're going to have to get more out of their offense, though, and that's just really difficult. I mean, if they do get to that point where they are really in some sort of contention, they're going to have to get a bat somewhere. And I don't know if that would be someone to replace Nori Aoki or, you know, someone for third base or maybe even DH if Billy Butler's still having issues. I don't know what they would do.
I think what they need to do is, like what we talked about last week, they need to just go for it and not give a crap about anybody on the team. And what I mean by that is, like, you go out and get the best bat and you'll fit him in somewhere. You know, don't care about hurting Hosmer's feelings. If you have to send down Moustakas to AAA again, do it. I'd rather have somebody who's hitting .280 with 20 home runs on July 31st than someone who's still hitting .185 with 4 home runs. Oh, well, those were really high leverage home runs. You know, like, I don't care.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what the Royals need to do. They have never, in any moves that they've made, really, at least that I can recall, shown any sort of killer instinct of, you know, we're going to sacrifice something like a Greg Holland because we have a Wade Davis that can come in and be the closer. And we're going to go out and we're going to get somebody that we're going to bring in and we're going to find a spot for him. If we have to cut Aoki or we have to, you know, send Billy Butler to the minors or put him on the bench or, you know, do something, we're going to find a spot for this bat. That's what they need to do. I don't have any particular, as we get closer, I'll start researching and finding names of people that might actually fit. in terms of, you know, who could be a bat that could be had for someone like a Greg Holland or something. But I mean, and it's one of those things, like you said, you, like you just said, I want to believe, you know. Well, I mean, I do too. My head, my heart is telling me, you know, why not us? But my head is telling me it's not going to happen because the Royals aren't going to make a trade because to them, their lineup is set. They think we've got the person we want at every single position, and there's no reason for us because they're going to get better. They're going to get better. You hear how many times you hear it in the press conferences? They're going to get better. They're going to get better. They're going to get better. That's all they say. And so they're not going to go out there. Whereas every team that makes the playoffs, if there's a team this year that's close to where the Royals are that ends up making the playoffs, I would highly probable that they probably made a move at the break or at the trade deadline.
Yeah, and they got to do something significant. I mean, last year the big deadline kind of deals were Justin Maxwell and Emilio Bonifacio, and neither of those are on the big league team now. I mean, they got, you know, Bonifacio did all right for his time here, and Maxwell did really well as, at the same time, but you know, neither of those are guys that you put into a lineup that instantly makes you better. I mean, I would think of guys like a Chase Headley type, or I don't know any names off the top of my head that might be available. It's probably still a little early to be looking at that here in, you know, the second week of June, but they would need to do something. I mean, they have holes in this offense, and they have to fill those if they're going to actually be making a legitimate play for it. I don't know if they would trade Holland. That seems like if a team's trading for Holland, they feel they're in it, they're not going to give up a big bat. They'd probably give up prospects. But, he's marketable. They have Wade Davis in line next year, who could probably do that closer's role. Little adjustments. So I mean,
You'd have to find somebody like say the Dodgers, who've got kind of a log jam in their outfield of players.
Oh,
like
yeah.
Any one of those four outfielders that the Dodgers have mm-hmm. would be the best offensive player on this team right now.
Yeah.
So I mean, you've got to find somebody like that who has a surplus somewhere. Mm-hmm. And still needs a closer. And I mean, that was just off the top of my head, but I mean, that actually could work. Because, you know, I don't know what the Dodgers closer situation is. I don't know if they were using Brian Wilson last year. Was he just a reliever?
He was just kind of in the middle. They've used Kenley Jansen, I think, most of the time this year.
Whoever they're using is not as good as Greg Holland, we'll put it that way.
Right.
So, and the Dodgers right now are 33-31. So they're close, just like the Royals are. So, I mean, you know, just something to keep your eye on, I guess.
Well, and the Dodgers, I think they have Jock Peterson in their minor league system, too. So it's not like they're trading an established guy out of their lineup. Well, you know, they have a guy who could reasonably fill in to kind of take that place if there were injuries or, you know, they needed to mix somebody else in there. So,
the big question
have to do it.
Yeah, I mean, the big question then becomes, are the Royals willing to take on the payroll because they're all their outfielders are pretty well paid, or at least the ones they'd be willing to get rid of. So that becomes a concern, but we don't have to worry about that at this point.
Yeah, we can look at that next month.
Yeah. So moving on, we're going to talk about last night, winning pitcher last night, James Shields. James Shields has hit kind of a bumpy road this last month or so, and if you look at the box score from last night, his line wasn't terrible. I mean, he had he had six innings pitched, six hits, one run, two walks, eight strikeouts. So I mean, pretty good. But you know, he let a decent amount on base. I mean,
he made it eight. Interesting.
Yes, he
in that second inning.
I mean, that line looks better than it was, because there were the second inning, he was in some trouble. I mean, he had some issues with, you know, people on base, and he got out of it. And to his credit, he's very good at that. He's proven to be, very good at that in his career. But he's hit kind of a bumpy road. He was, like we talked about, he was the worst start in the Cardinals series, and that was he gave up a grand slam. I think he gave up another home run. I mean, he ended up giving up seven runs in that game. And so and this kind of came up last year, where there was a point in time where he actually hit kind of a skid. Weirdly enough, it coincided with the Royals' skid, I believe. But I remember people talking about it, and they were going back, and you look throughout his career, and he always seems to have one or two bad months every year. Now, in the case of 2010, it's pretty much every month, because that was like his worst year as a pro.
That was a rough year.
Yes. But other than that, he's been a very, very good and dependable pitcher. And there's always one or two months. So we looked at it, and you look at his career splits. Okay, so for the months of March and April, which is mostly April and probably just a day or two of March at most for any year, but his ERA and 304 innings pitched is 2.93. And then if you go to May, his ERA is 3.58 for 329.1 innings pitched. This is for his career, by the way. And then we'll skip to August, and he has 314.2 innings pitched and a 3.17 ERA. And September, October, 266 innings and 3.82 ERA. So all his highest ERA in those 4 months is 3.8, or those four sections, because I guess March and April and September, October are, you know, four separate months, but really
it's more it's or the less. Same
it's,
month, basically.
Yeah, it's more or less. In terms of the season, it's basically the same month. But so the 3.82 is his highest ERA. But then you come back to June, and his ERA is 4.26 for his career on 281 innings pitched. And then in July, it's 5.05 and 279.2 innings pitched. And, I mean, across the board, his numbers, you look at his batting average given up, it's 282 in the month of July, 267 in June, not any higher than 262 anywhere else. You know, I mean, his slugging percentage, his the on-base percentage that he gives up, everything is higher in those months. And there was an interesting article in the Kansas City Star that Mike's going to talk about that maybe had a possible reason why there's this kind of consistent disparity, if you will.
Yeah, there's and this is Just in the Gamer from Andy McCullough, and basically he starts it out talking about James Shields and how the morning of that start he had a lot of trouble with allergies. And you know, if you look at where his struggles start up, you know, and this is like, you know, he's talking, Shield is talking about how it's, he has difficulty with, you know, breathing and getting through, and he's waiting for Claritin to kick in and things like that. And when you see that his struggles seem to coincide with certain months, warmer months, more spring months, where things are growing and allergies are out there, yeah, I think that's kind of a reasonable kind of connection to make there, where you could see, okay, it's, you know, it's something you don't ever really think about, because it's so easy to get stuck thinking that these guys are, you know, just names in the box score, but you know, they have, you know, these guys have allergies and they will get sick and this will happen. And if it's something that's a constant thing, you know, it's just going to happen. You know, it's what that player has to deal with. And, you know, Shields, maybe by now, maybe he could know how to adjust to it. But at the same time, you know, when I have allergies, I don't know when they're going to hit, you know, so I don't really have a way to prevent them for myself. So I can understand how if somebody else is going to have the same kind of situation. But what I also thought was pretty interesting was in those bad months, and I guess it would make sense if he's having poorer starts that he'll throw fewer innings. But, you know, maybe it's also an endurance thing where in those early months, you know, you're getting into the middle of the year. You've kind of gotten past where you're fresh in April and May, and now you're starting to get into the warmer months. So you have all this conspiring against him. And I think that's a reasonable explanation for why he might struggle in those middle months. And, you know, then he kind of puts it back together and finishes strong historically. So, you know, I thought that was an interesting piece out of McCullough's story. And when you look at the numbers, you know, I think it's there's a connection there. I don't think it's definitive. I think there's so many other factors that could be involved, but you know, it does give you at least something to kind of start with. Is like, you know, James Shields, who we've talked about, is one of the top pitchers in baseball. And why does he struggle in these certain months? And maybe that's an explanation why. So I thought that was a pretty interesting part.
Yeah, you know, it's definitely really interesting. And it could be kind of, as you said, just that perfect storm where after he starts to get tired before he catches his second wind, and it just so happens to coincide with these allergies, and he has trouble breathing. And, you know, if you have trouble breathing, I mean, that's being able to, for all athletes, but for pitchers too, like that's a big part of kind of how you have to maintain your endurance, is being able to breathe properly. I know like people like Alan Yeager, when he came on the show, he talked a lot about that too. I mean, it's not just when you have people that have pitching programs like that, it's not just about, you know, long toss and things like that. There's also, he works on just breathing. He does a lot of yoga, a lot of things like that to try and help a pitcher, you know, maintain control of, you know, his body when he's on the mound. And if you're feeling like your body is out of control because of allergies or something, then that can kind of mess with you and can affect things. Maybe it affects his eyesight. You know, he's got watery eyes or something. I mean, I have some allergies sometimes, and, you know, my head kind of feels like it's swimming because my sinuses are all stuffed up and everything. So, I mean, again, we're not trying to say there's anything definitive, but it's an interesting notion that this could possibly be. And the evidence is there to at least support some sort of causation within those 2 months, whether it's endurance or whether it's allergies or whether it's kind of both of them. But just something to note and something to keep an eye on, because he, you know, he might continue, he might kind of go up and down for the next month or so until his body and kind of evens out, whether it's with the allergies or catching his second wind for the rest of the season. But he has, over his career, shown the ability to finish strong. So I guess, long story short, neither Mike nor I are worried about James Shields at all. Even, I mean, he pitched really well last night, or I guess well enough, pretty well last night, but, you know, we're not worried from some of the rocky starts, I should say.
Yep.
So with that, I think we're going to take our first break here, and then we come back on the other side. We're going to talk about Eric Hosmer and his worthiness in the number 3 hole for this current Royals lineup when we come back on the other side.
Come to Spit Cup this week. We'll let the person who has the highest bar tab ride the bull. We don't have any TVs in our bar, but we make our own entertainment. Mondays, it's free cover charge to anybody with a gun rack in their pickup truck. Tuesdays, we've got $8 beer night. All domestic beers are on special for only $8. It's Spit Cup. Wednesdays is longest tobacco spit. Thursdays is foot fungus night. Friday night is jamboree night. Bring your crap kick in your 10-gallon hats. And this weekend, you get our world-famous Spit Cup girls. You get to pick which one has the most teeth. It's Spit Cup. No love letters. Talking to the wall.
Or you could go to Kelly's Westport Inn. The highest quality drinks with the lowest prices. You know what we do. Drinks, friends, plenty of TV showing sports. They've got all the basketball and all the baseball on. Live music on the weekends. The best pizza in Kansas City and fun. Kelly's has the best rooftop patio in town and is voted one of the best places in Kansas City to check out the view, if you know what I mean, and maybe make a new friend. Make the best choice for your evening entertainment, Kelly's Westport Inn. Kelly's is at 500 Westport Road in Kansas City, Missouri. Kelly's Westport Inn.
And welcome back into the Kansas City Baseball Vault, brought to you by Kelly's Westport Inn. Thank you for sticking with us through the break. I am Jeff Herr. With me is Michael Engel. Now we're going to talk, we kind of recapped how the Royals have been doing lately in the first half and talked a little bit about James Shields and some of the troubles that he was having and how he'll hopefully be coming out of it. But now we're going to talk about everyone's favorite topic, which is the offense. And I mean, let's talk about Eric Hosmer, because we early in the season, when Mike Moustakas was having all his troubles, everyone was talking about him. He was the big focus. And you looked at Hosmer, and he was hitting, you know, 310, 320, and it was mostly empty. He didn't have a lot of power, but he was still hitting well enough. He was producing. He hit a lot of double. So I guess I shouldn't say no power, but the power wasn't what you wanted. And so, you know, things were still okay. It wasn't a huge deal. But now, Eric Hosmer has, I mean, he's basically been Mike Moustakas over the last month. And there's been a lot of talk over, you know, what's wrong with him. What could be causing any of this? I mean, if you look, okay, March, April, he hit 301 and for a batting average. In May, he hit 246. And now so far in June, in 8 games, he's hitting 152. So, I mean, he is not hitting very well recently. And despite all that, he continues to be placed in the number 3 spot in the lineup, or at least in the, I think he's done some slight shuffling when Infante was still out and we kind of moved him up to second. So, you know, top 3, more or less. He's been there basically the whole year without recourse. And I mean, here's another situation where you have the Royals and one of these, this, you know, the flippant term is just these golden calf, you know, the Eric Hosmer's, Mike Moustakas' of the world that are just completely held without accountability for anything. And so, I mean, if Escobar was, or, I mean, how many times have they moved Billy Butler around this year? And, you know, they've moved him. He's been in the 3-hole. He's been in the 4. He's been down at the 5. I mean, they've kind of tried to shake things up with him to move him around to get him going. You know, you've had in years past when Alex Gordon has struggled a little bit, they've yanked him around the lineup a bunch of different times. Escobar's batting first one day. He's batting ninth the next. He's batting second. Then he's batting seventh. You know, who knows what he's doing. But here you have Eric Hosmer, who has proven over the last month that he is not a hitter worthy of getting some of the, you know, the third most at bats in the game. And yet here he is. I mean, what does this tell you, Mike, about what this Royals organization does and how they view Eric Hosmer?
Well, they're pinning their hopes on him big time, and rightfully so. I mean, he was a top prospect, and I don't think any, you know, in 2011 he debuted and was great, and, you know, 2012 struggled, 2013 seemed to rebound, and started 2014 pretty well. And I think you see flashes. Like, I don't think that he's like ruined to the extent of like Mike Moustakas, who I have zero expectations for anymore. But the last month has been really tough. I mean, he came out of that, had that 7-game stretch on the road on the West Coast where he had 14 hits and 31 at bats and was just going crazy. Like, he hit everything. And since then, you know, he's only hit 167. He did hit his second homer, but he struck out 25 times in the last 26 games, and he's only walked 4 times. And through it all, he's hit either second or third in the lineup, with the exception of one day. In one day where he was against Houston, that last game of the Houston series, they put him at 5th for that one day and batted Alex Gordon 3rd. And Hosmer went 2-for-4, and the next day was back number 3, and he hasn't moved since. From those top 2 or 3 spots. So, you know, I think that's pretty telling about what they want out of him. They want him to be the number 3 hitter. Yost will talk about how he doesn't want to mix things up too much. He wants the guys to hit the clubhouse and know, okay, I'm going to be hitting 3rd. This is what I'm going to do. That's what it is. I can prepare. My mindset is there. And I get that, and to an extent, sure, maybe Yost knows his players well enough to think that, okay, this is going to be beneficial to them. But at the same time, if you've got a guy who for a month is not hitting, I think he has 4 multi-hit games in the last month, you've got to do something. And especially when you have a guy who can fill that number 3 spot, who has been hitting, like Alex Gordon, who's, you know, he went on a tear of like a 9-10 game hitting streak, went hitless, then hit in 6 straight games. You know, right away, he's getting extra base hits. He's getting on base. I think he's walked in his last 7 games and 8 of his last 10. You know, and that also includes getting hits. So Gordon's just getting on base like a machine right now. And when you put Hosmer 3rd and you put Gordon 5th, you're saying that you want Eric Hosmer to get more at-bats in the game. And maybe it's only one game. Maybe it's one more plate appearance in that game. But over the course of a season and over the course of, say, a month, that really works out to be, you know, some significant opportunities missed, where you have a guy like Gordon who is, you know, franchise type of player, who's hitting well, who could have done some damage in spots where Eric Hosmer ended up not doing damage. So that's, I think that's the biggest beef in this is, you know, at least with Moustakas, they said, okay, well, we don't have an alternative. And to an extent, they were kind of okay to get away with that, just because, you know, Siriaco is not that guy and Paredes is not that guy and Giafatel is not that guy. And even as bad as Moustakas was, the alternatives weren't much better. But in this case, there's a very clear alternative to hit third in the lineup, and his name's Alex Gordon. And I don't know why, if it's just absolute stubbornness or pride or overwrought optimism that's causing it. But you can't sit there and say with a straight face that Eric Hosmer has shown a lot of signs of improving. There was that game against St. Louis where he struck out four times, or was it three times, I think. Let me check the game logs real quick. Yeah, he struck out four times. It looked awful, and like it was like clockwork. You strike one, strike two, and then you just throw it in the dirt, and he's chasing it. He looked terrible, and the Royals did nothing. You know, they batted him third the next day, and the next day, and the next day. And so the end result is that, you know, you've missed some spots where Alex Gordon could have helped the team, and Eric Hosmer maybe could have taken some pressure off of himself and relaxed and had a chance at the five spot. I don't think there's, you know, too much of a problem putting that guy fifth, and especially if you've got Alex Gordon ready to step in, batting third. He's shown great power. He's shown good patience. I mean, it seems like a no-brainer to me.
Yeah, and you know, when you watch Eric Hosmer, to me, what I see from him is kind of just from a macro viewpoint that the organization as a whole cannot recognize why Eric Hosmer is failing. Because if you look at him, we've talked about it on this show, watch the catcher every time Eric Hosmer comes to the plate. Every time the pitcher gets set, you know, when a pitcher is going to throw a pitch outside, sometimes the catcher will kind of, you know, take a small step to the outside of whatever, you know, right or left-handed pitcher or hitter that's up. And when Eric Hosmer is up, you watch the catcher every pitch. They do that. They take one small step to the outside when the pitcher gets set, because they know they can throw it low and outside. He's going to go fishing for it every time. And he has not shown an ability to get better, which it's one of two things. It's the organization not being able to identify that this is an issue. And two, that they identified as an issue and they keep telling him about it and he's ignoring it. Either way, it's a big problem. And he's just swinging at pitches, and he's swinging hard at pitches that he shouldn't be. And then you look at him after he swings and he nearly falls over. He's out of balance. I remember seeing something that's really stuck with me. This was a few years ago when Albert Pujols was still on with the Cardinals. I saw they diagrammed his swing on Baseball Tonight. I think it was John Kruk who was doing it, who was a pretty good hitter in his own right. But they showed Albert Pujols as he was in his stance right before the pitch was about to arrive. And he basically, they drew it on the teleprompter. It was more or less a perfect triangle, showing that he had a good base under him, his knees were level, and then his elbows were level and parallel to his knees. You know, in terms of if you drew lines, if you could imagine drawing lines across where his elbow was and then where his knees were. And then his step that he took was a very, very small step forward that didn't affect his base at all, still kept him balanced and even. And what do you know, Albert Pujols is like the greatest hitter of our generation. So, I mean, when you look at that, and then you look at Eric Hosmer, and you see a guy who has an uneven stance. He then, when he swings out of his shoes, and he falls over, literally falls mm-hmm. over, and has to catch himself, and then readjust. You know, I mean, these are problems, and what not only makes me think that it's more the former of the previous two options that I had, that the Royals can't identify this as an issue, is because just this last week, Ned Yost was asked, hey, Hosmer's been falling over a lot when he swings, especially on a, you know, swing and miss type of a scenario. Is that a problem? Have you guys been looking at that? Are you trying to fix this? Ned Yost literally, I cannot even describe how, I don't know, just that this is even said, but he said, you want your hitter to fall forward after they swing. And I think it was Danny Clingscale who was asking this question on the interview, because I heard it on both 810 and 610 the same day. But I think it was Danny Clingscale was asking the question, and he followed it up with what? Is basically what he followed up with. And he, Yost kept going. He's like, yeah, you want him, you know, you want your hitter to be aggressive. You want him to swing hard, or whatever. I'm kind of paraphrasing, but the part is a direct quote where he says, you want your hitter to fall forward. And then he even went further and said, if you look back at all the great hitters, they all do that. And that is just unequivocally false. I mean, you look at Albert Pujols, you look at Barry Bonds, go back and look at what film there is of Ted Williams, you look at Hank Aaron, look at George Brett, for crying out loud, and none of them do what Eric Hosmer does. And the Royals, either it seems like they can't identify this as an issue. Either that or they... I guess what's worse is if they're trying to say, oh man, something's wrong with Hosmer and we can't figure out what it is. I don't know if that's worse or if it's, oh man, nothing's wrong with Hosmer. That looks great. It's just bad luck. You know, I don't know which is worse, to be honest. I mean, the correct answer is neither's worse and neither's better. You want them to be able to identify, but it's sad. And then you talk about, not only is there a clear alternative with Alex Gordon, but then you've got Lorenzo Cain, who is batting sixth for most of the year, and granted he's missed quite a few games, but he's past that small sample size point now because he has played himself over 40 games, and that's usually the point, like we talked about earlier on this show, that it's usually the point that we talk about as, you know, you're starting to believe in something. And I don't think Lorenzo Cain is going to hit 330 this year, because that's like batting title good. But I do think that, I mean, 285 is a distinct possibility at this point. You know, he could be having like an Escobar 2012 type of season, you know, where you say, okay, you know, maybe it's a career year, but he's going to still hit pretty well, I think. And he's hitting really well. And so if you can even move Alex Gordon up to third, and you could put Lorenzo Cain at fifth, and then you can put Hosmer at sixth and even decrease that pressure even more. And I mean, the Royals have these options, and it just seems like they look at Lorenzo Cain, they look at Alex Gordon, they look at Eric Hosmer, and they say, you should be our three hitter Eric Hosmer, you should be our five hitter Alex Gordon, and you should be our six hitter Lorenzo Cain. And because that's the kind of player that you are, and I'm a baseball guy, and I've never been wrong in 30 years, and that's where you're hitting. And it's just, the whole thing is disconcerting, because I'd really like to believe the Royals don't believe that. I'd really like to believe that the Royals are more advanced than this guttural 1970s, you know, baseball is a feeling type of a thing, but they give literally no evidence to suggest that.
Yeah, I think they're stuck with the mindset that your leadoff hitter is that scrappy guy, slaps it, you know, on the ground, gets to first base. Your second hitter needs to be the guy with the bat control who can lay down a bunt or get the hit and run going. And then the number three hitter is your power guy. And number four is another power guy. And then fifth is, you know, power guy, but maybe some contact problems. And so, you know, they're stuck in that kind of mindset. And you see Nori Aoki, who isn't really doing all that great, below average walk rate, you know, hasn't been hitting very well, you know, and had a heck of a week where he basically got hit by a ball that he swung at. He did a barrel roll across home plate while trying to score. He slid after a foul ball and got hit where you don't want to get hit.
To put it kindly.
And, you know, and it just seems like he has no control of his body. Hosmer is off balance every time he swings. and, you know, has struck out the most of anybody on the team, and he's getting the most plate appearances of anybody. So it seems like they're just not willing to change that. Now, I could understand that maybe there are concerns with Kane if you wanted to move him to second or lead off, that he's not a guy who walks much either. And, you know, he's never done great at either of those spots when he's been placed there. But at the same time, he's hitting well. And he's a guy that doesn't really have to have a ton of power if he can get on base, because he's fast and he can, you know, he runs the bases really well. And if you have a lineup of like Kane, Infante, Gordon, I think that scores more than what they're doing right now with Aoki, Infante, and Hosmer. And even at least the unwillingness to try it is kind of the most frustrating thing, because, I mean, that could be runs. That could be opportunities right there where you're taking your best hitters, you're giving them the chance to hit and do what they're doing really well. You know, and over the course of the season, those kind of things can add up. I mean, it kind of varies by year, but in general, your leadoff hitter is going to get maybe, you know, 17 to 20 more plate appearances per year than your number two hitter. Your number two hitter is going to get about 18 more than your number three hitter, who's going to get about 16, 17 more than your four hitter, and, you know, so on and so forth. And so, you know, just some numbers I pulled up briefly, and this is just kind of the first link that I found, but this is average plate appearances by lineup position. Your number three hitter is, you know, gets about 728 or 725 in the AL for this link, and I'll post this on the thing, or I'll find better numbers or whatnot. But the number five hitter, 693. So right there, you're looking at, you know, 32 plate appearances. Well, you know, if you break that down to a player getting four plate appearances per game, I mean, that could be the impact of eight different games for a player, you know, if you wanted to look at it in that kind of light. And they're willingly putting guys in positions to not do that. They're letting hitters hit more who haven't hit well at the expense of hitters who have hit well. And it doesn't make any logical sense to me to take that approach just to stick with the old school mentality. Like, I don't think it's going to hurt to try to do something different. You know, Yost, I think the quote that he said was that, you know, it's a big deal to people who want to talk about stuff. It doesn't make that big of a deal in the context of the game. Okay, that's fine. But at the same time, if it doesn't make that big of a deal in the context of the game, then you have no real threat or risk in trying to change something. If it's not that big of a deal what the lineup is, and, you know, to some extent maybe it isn't, but if it's not that big of a deal, why not try something? Why not at least get a look at it and see if it changes something? You know, I don't think it's going to be something where Kane and Gordon suddenly stop hitting because they got moved into different spots. And, you know, maybe you do take some pressure off guys, and, you know, now you get Hosmer hitting again, you get Infante hitting again, and you still get Kane and Gordon hitting. And then overall, your lineup looks a lot better. So I don't see why there's not a willingness to try it, you know, other than just stubbornness or just complete ignorance of any kind of issue.
Yeah, because I think crap, I just lost my train of thought. It's okay. Yep, lost it. Damn, I had a really good point I was going for there. God, maybe it'll come back to me. But I do think one of the things that I was thinking of when you were talking was that when you talk about the Royals having this mindset of these players that have to, you know, bat in these positions or in the lineup. Well, the worst part is, and I think this is where it kind of comes from, the whole Ned Yost, I've never been wrong thing. And so Nori Aoki has not been very good this year, but taking that out of the equation, the last couple years, he's been pretty good, and he's been a good leadoff hitter. Well, the Royals look and they say, okay, Nori Aoki is a scrappy guy, he's fast, he makes a lot of contact, doesn't have a lot of power. He should be a leadoff guy. And it just so happens that he's a leadoff guy, you know, and he's been good one in his career. The problem is the Royals see that and they draw the wrong connection. You know, they fulfill their own prophecy, if you will, of this guy has these skills and that's why he should be a leadoff hitter. And look, he's a good leadoff hitter. So we're right for thinking this. This is validation for our way of thought, which is just, it's just not accurate because Aoki gets on base, let's take this year out of the equation so far.
Yeah,
because he's in Milwaukee. This year has been poor, but when he was in Milwaukee, I mean, he was a good guy because he got on base and he was fast. So, you know, not only when he got on base, I'm not talking about stealing because I'm not a huge fan of steals, but when he gets on base and he can make things happen when, you know, he can go first to third on a single and he can score from first on a gap or double or something like that. You know, that's what made him a good leadoff hitter, not because he makes contact and can steal bases. You know, I mean, those just happen to be other skills that he has. So, you know, I think there's a lot of factors at play, but I mean, ultimately, and maybe I feel like the lineup is something that people talk about every year, and you get a lot of people saying,
"Oh yeah."
Oh, here's the point I was gonna get that I forgot. I think the irrefutable, because you might be right, Mike, that. Just the point that you said of maybe it's really not that big of a factor. It could be. But one of the one irrefutable piece of evidence is what you just brought up, that every place in the lineup from 1 to 9 decreases the amount of plate appearances over a season and even within a particular game. So you just cannot dispute the fact that your number one leadoff hitter is going to have more at-bats over 162 game season than your number two hitter, than your number three hitter, and so on down the line. So knowing that, you know, the extension of that logic is let's put our better hitters in these spots, because I mean, if you could ask Ned Yost right now, okay, Alex Gordon just hit a screaming double off the wall, would you like Alex Gordon to bat again right now? He'd be like, yeah, absolutely. Get a ghost runner out there like we're playing schoolyard baseball and bring Alex Gordon back up to the plate. You know, it's like we're playing cricket. Sweet. But for those who don't know, in cricket, if you hit the ball and you run from one wicket and then you run back to the other wicket, then you get to keep hitting. So that's the cricket reference. But anyway,
Billy Butler would suck at cricket.
Yes, he would. He would suck very hard at
cricket. I'm sorry, Billy.
That's just a fact of life. But the point is, though, if you take it in a silo and you ask someone like Ned Yost or Dayton Moore, well, don't you want your best hitter hitting all the time? The answer would be yes. So when it comes to lineup construction, why not try and take advantage of the fact that you know the statistical fact that this position is going to get more at bats, not only in this game, but over the course of the entire season, you know? So, I mean, the only time that the leadoff hitter does not get more at bats than anybody else is when you have a no hitter. And how often does that happen?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, the only time, and that's not even the case too, because if it's a perfect game, because if you have a walk, then the leadoff hitter is going to come up again. So, I mean, I don't know how you could possibly ignore that logic when you're trying to think of hey, this is what we're trying to accomplish. We want our best hitters up more often than our not best hitters. You know, it seems quite simple, but then it's like they can't get out of their own way in typical Royals fashion, and they look and say, hey, you know, this is what we think a lineup should be. So we're not going to use this information that we have.
Yeah, and I think I'll have to find the article that this would have came from, but I think in spring training, when, you know, there's always the manager announces the opening day lineup or something, you know, the Yost at that point was saying exactly that he wanted his best hitters to get up there more often. And now he's turned around and says it's not that big of a deal. And, you know, I think some of it's just going to be manager speak and double talk and whatnot. But that's really frustrating to have it have to flip that way. And so, you know, when you look at that in the context of what the Royals did this offseason, where they specifically looked to find Nori Aoki as their leadoff guy, and they went out and acquired him. You know, they did that also with the idea that they're going to move Alex Gordon down, who did a great job as a leadoff hitter. You know, he's not the typical kind of leadoff hitter, but he does all those things you would want him to do. He can get on base. He can hit the ball. He's a great base runner. He's smartest base runner on the team, probably the smartest player on the team. That's the guy that you want. And if you look at the trend of baseball as a whole, generally teams are starting to put their best hitter batting second with the idea that, okay, you know, now you can maybe get a guy on base for your best hitter and have him bat second and also get them more at bats over the course of a game, over the course of a season. And that's kind of what the trend is. And so I don't know why that is such a difficult thing to see for the Royals, unless they just absolutely believe that the lineup that they have is the best that they can do, which I think the numbers would bear it out that it's not. And I think that the track record of guys like Alex Gordon would indicate that, you know, he should be hitting higher and you can rely on him to hit higher. And I don't know why the Royals don't do it other than stubbornness or just unwillingness to even think differently or try something new. I guess that's still stubbornness. That's redundant, but whatever. Or they just don't know it. You know, and I don't think that's the case. I think they do know that, you know, it's not a difficult concept to wrap your head around that the guy who starts the game is probably going to be the guy who comes around next, you know, when once you turn the lineup over. And it just makes complete sense. And so, you know, if they're not doing it, then I don't know what they're thinking at this stage, especially when the lineup could use a boost and they just changed hitting coaches. They're not afraid to change hitting coaches. Why aren't they afraid to change, you know, the lineup that goes out there? It's it doesn't make any sense to me.
Yeah. So with that, I think we'll kind of wrap up today. We caught up on how the Royals were going. We talked a little bit about James Shields and how his difficulties hopefully are a yearly occurrence, but hopefully they'll be shorter this year, and the lineup construction with what as we just got finished talking about. So like I said, I think we'll wrap up with that. Hopefully when we get back next week, they won't be done with this 9-game stretch that we were talking about, but hopefully they will be well into it and making up some ground like we were talking that they could. Because as we said, this could be a big turning point for the Royals season here. So I'm not going to hold my breath, but I do think it's certainly possible. So with that, we'll end this show. This has been the Kansas City Baseball Vault, brought to you by Kelly's Westport Inn. And I am
let's be
I'm struggling. I'm struggling to end this show. I'm trying to end on a hopeful note here. But yeah, hopefully we got
it some... started hopeful.
It did, because they put together some quality baseball. So hopefully they keep it going and get even better. But we will be able to discuss whether they do or not next week on this show. So thanks for tuning in once again to the Kansas City Baseball Vault, brought to you by Kelly's Westport Inn. I am your host, Jeff Herr. With me, as always, the incomparable Michael Engel. Thanks for stopping by. And as always, go Royals.
You have been listening to a Royals Podcast Network presentation.